You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. After a mild winter, an early start to summer heat, and with nearly half of Oregon's counties facing drought conditions, fire departments and districts across the state are preparing for a busy fire season. Oregon's Department of Forestry announced the start of fire season last week. Clatsop County is not one of the counties currently considered in drought, but here, nearly all fires are caused by people. Napa Fire Chief Kirk Donaldson said people in Clatsop County can prevent fires by being proactive. If you see or smell smoke or fire, do not hesitate to call your local fire department as a precautionary measure. Donaldson said if you plan to have a campfire, make sure it is properly extinguished after use and cover the remains of the fire with dirt. Donaldson said the fire season will likely end in October, but that does not mean the region is safe from fire risk. He said most fire departments in the county have received staffing grants from ODF, which allows them to bring on extra personnel to be on standby. In Astoria, open burning is not permitted within city limits. However, burning in burn barrels or recreational burning is allowed with a permit. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. The Lower Columbia Preservation Society hopes to remove barriers to home repairs with a new tool library. For $40 a year, locals will now be able to rent up to 7 quality hand tools and small electrical power tools for up to 7 days at a time. Program manager Misty Sillinger said the tool library will allow community members to extend the lives of their belongings without purchasing one-time use items. Starting July 5th, the library will be open from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. on Sundays, right after the Astoria Sunday Market. People will also be able to schedule appointments for pickup and drop-off. Board member Rob Charnock said people can help the mission by volunteering or donating clean working tools, with the exception of gas-powered equipment. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. A judge in Eugene has questioned the safety of the new fence at the downtown federal building. KLCC's Nathan Wilk reports.
The federal government fenced off the building's upper courtyard in April after a riot was declared at a protest there in January. But local activists then sued over free speech and accessibility concerns. Federal Judge Mustafa Kasubai will decide whether to issue a preliminary injunction. In court Thursday, the government's lawyers argued organizers could ask for a permit to use the fenced-off area. But Kasubai questioned how people would get out in an emergency, as the fence's gates are locked from the inside. He said he didn't want a, quote, kill box. The building's manager, Ryan Anderson, said those details would be determined when someone actually applies for a permit. Kasubai then toured the site Thursday afternoon. The court will reconvene Monday morning. This is Nathan Wilk reporting.
Oregon welcomed a new professional women's softball league last week. The Portland Cascade are a part of the Athletes Unlimited Softball League and play at the Hillsboro Ballpark. Kyra Buckley was at the inaugural game.
A sold-out crowd of more than 3,000 fans cheered on the Portland Cascade as the team defeated the Oklahoma City Spark 3-0. Cascade pitcher Sam Landry says the enthusiastic crowd at the Hillsboro Ballpark was engaged for all 7 innings.
Portland's bought in, and we're bought in for Portland as well.
This is the first season Athletes Unlimited softball teams are connected to cities. Last year, 4 teams traveled to play in 10 different ballparks. The league expanded to 6 franchises for this 2026 season, which runs through July 25th. I'm Kyra Buckley reporting.
When it comes to carbon storage, trees get a lot of attention, but now researchers are finding it in unusual places, including ancient landslides. OPB's April Ehrlich has more.
There are nearly 10,000 landslides across western Oregon. They're made up of rock, soil, and plants. And it turns out that mixture holds a lot more carbon than scientists previously thought. That's according to a study out of University of Oregon. Earth science professor Josh Roering says these findings could help researchers determine which areas to prioritize for conservation.
If we want to start managing watersheds For carbon, we first need to know how much is out there and what areas are going to be helpful to target for preservation and conservation efforts.
Roering helped lead the study published in Science Advances. He plans to build off it by studying mountainous areas where landslides haven't occurred. I'm April Ehrlich reporting.
American pikas are fluffy, squeaky, and adorable, and they're what's known as an indicator species. So if they're doing okay, there's a good chance the local ecosystem is doing okay too. That's one reason why the Oregon Zoo and other groups are looking for people this summer to go out and count pikas. Christian Fodenvenzel tagged along with one of these citizen scientists and filed this report.
Wildlife photographer Linda Stider pushes through the underbrush at Little Beacon Rock in the Columbia River Gorge. She's trying to reach the bottom of a moss-covered rock slide.
If you look up, there's smaller boulders, basketball-sized boulders. If the rocks are too small, like 5 or 6 inches, that's too small to have decent holes underneath for the pikas to hide in.
She's looking for pikas, mammals with furry little bodies, about the size of a russet potato, and a call like a squeaky toy. Stider says all it took for her was one look at a pika in the wild.
Then I became obsessed.
Why?
Because they're so adorable. They're in the rabbit family. They're also called rock rabbits and boulder bunnies.
They have Mickey Mouse ears, little white feet, and no tails. Stider goes outdoors to count pikas at least once a week. She's with Cascades Pika Watch, which is looking for people to help them survey for pikas this summer.
They are what we call an indicator species, which means that by studying pika, we can understand how the larger habitat is doing.
Haley Brazier is the wildlife conservation specialist at the Oregon Zoo. She says pikas have a very special habitat requirement, which is why you don't see them in your garden. They like to live at high elevations, in rocky outcroppings and slides where the boulders are just big enough for a potato to hide underneath.
Now, what's really special about the Columbia River Gorge is that is the lowest elevation that pikas live in the West. So we have this distinct opportunity living here in Portland to go out and study these pika at their lowest elevation.
Pikas are special for other reasons too. They need particular temperatures to thrive. In winter, they live under rocks coated with snow, so they're vulnerable to climate change. The state has listed them as a sensitive species, which is why scientists need a better understanding of their numbers and habitats, particularly following the Eagle Creek fire along the Columbia River Gorge in 2017.
So this is a real opportunity in the years following that fire for us to be seeing how do pika respond to these large wildfires.
Cascade Pika Watch already has over 400 trained volunteers, but it's still looking for more. Participants can train online for free. Linda Stider has been volunteering for over a decade and saw a 60% decline in pika populations in the Eagle Creek fire areas.
Oh, they are definitely recovering. A lot of the vegetation is growing back, so they are reproducing and dispersing.
Still, unlike rabbits, pikas don't breed quickly. They usually have just one litter a year.
And they only have one or two piglets.
Piglets?
Yes. P-I-K-L-E-T. So that makes them even more adorable.
Pika Watch volunteers choose from any of one of 90 sites identified by GPS locations. It could be along a hiking trail, at a scenic overlook, or even next to a parking area so people with mobility issues can also take part.
And we ask that you wait there for 25 minutes, and that's when you listen and look for any indication that there might be pika. So, for example, you're going to be listening for those cute little eep, those little squeak sounds that the pika make. You're going to be looking for pika, so they like to run all over the rocks. They're busy collecting food and doing other things. Or you're going to be looking for their scat, so you're going to look for their poop.
The data is then submitted by phone or computer and goes straight to the Columbia River Gorge Commission to help out with land management decisions. Back at Little Beacon Rock, a movement catches my eye.
Where are you pointing to in relationship to that lowest
green
branch?
Yes, lowest green branch, there's a shadow underneath it and something's moving.
Oh, yeah, I just saw it.
Is that a pika or is that... a dot in the matrix.
Well, I saw something move.
Oh, yeah. No, he's gone behind now. It was something. It was the first of many squirrels. Still, the hunt was so much fun, I'll be going back soon to see whether I can find my first pika. Christian Fodenwenzel, Beacon Rock State Park.
A recent analysis from the United Way found that about a third of Washington households are struggling to afford basic costs of living. KNKX's Anna Marie Yanni has more.
Stephanie Hoops is the national director of the United Way Research Project. She says the federal poverty level doesn't reflect the true cost of living in the state.
For a family of four, it's just over $30,000. And obviously, it's far more than that in most places, in every place in Washington state.
The United Way research team estimated a household of four in our state needs almost triple that amount to afford basic necessities. The researchers used federal and state data from 2024 to estimate costs of things like housing, food, health insurance, and car maintenance.
So in total, 37% of households across the state are struggling to afford just that basic survival budget.
The report painted a similar picture across the country. The national state average shows 41% of households are struggling to pay for those basic needs. In Washington, housing is the lead cost in the affordability burden. I'm Anna Marie Yanni reporting.
Every summer, a few dozen University of Washington faculty members climb aboard a bus and get away from the I-5 corridor. For many, it's their first chance to visit rural communities. This year's tour included several eastern Washington stops, including Spokane. SPR's Doug Nadvornik talked with these two participants.
Samantha Resnick came to the University of Washington a year and a half ago from Houston, Texas. Resnick is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences.
In Texas, I had the opportunity to evaluate our programs for best practice in early psychosis, which is my specialty. And so I traveled all around the state and got really familiar with these communities and their areas, what they needed, how they needed to adapt the programs.
Resnick says she's eager to get that same type of information about her new state.
I think for me today, actually driving through some rural areas in eastern Washington, and particularly stopping over near Odessa, Washington, was very eye-opening because I work with a lot of individuals in communities in rural Washington that are less than 1,000 people. And I serve patients all across the state of Washington via telehealth. It's very different to talk with someone on telehealth versus actually see their community and learn from them in person what their lives are like.
Resnick says there's another benefit to this trip. Faculty members get some FaceTime with President Robert Jones and Provost Tricia Serio.
Her commitment in time to this endeavor shows how much she believes in this and really wants to make sure that faculty are not just, you know, doing world-class research, but also connecting with the Washington community and serving the citizens of Washington.
Also on the trip was Philip Womble, an assistant professor in the School of Public Policy and Governance.
A lot of my work focuses on water rights and water management in the Western United States, and then more broadly, natural resources policy issues.
Womble came to Washington from the University of North Carolina.
I think Washington has some of the most interesting water issues anywhere in the world, but I'm pretty new to the state, and so this field tour has presented an opportunity to see a bunch of different geography across the state, see how water and natural resources are, you know, crucial to the state, and not only learn about the resources themselves, but also interact with and be in the communities that depend on and rely on those resources.
Womble, Resnick, and their colleagues were in Spokane for an event at the Health Partnership Building that the UW shares with Gonzaga. It's the facility where medical students start their training. There, the faculty members mingled with incoming freshmen.
I've had the opportunity to work on research with several outstanding undergraduate research assistants in my 2 years now at UW. I've been really impressed by their capabilities. Some of these undergraduates are performing at a, you know, graduate level early on. And so I'm excited to meet these new students and talk with them about how they might engage once they arrive on our campus.
The Eastern Washington leg of the tour also featured stops in the Tri-Cities for a tour of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, the farm of Ritzville State Senator Mark Schessler, and Grand Coulee Dam. I'm Doug Nadvornik reporting.
Generally, ticks in Oregon don't transmit disease as often as those in the eastern U.S. However, as KLCC's Karen Richard reports, the sheer number of ticks is higher this year.
Ticks have been moving north as the climate changes, and their diseases are moving with them. That's according to Dr. Patrick Ludke, Lane County's senior public health officer. He says Lane County has two main types of ticks, one of which can transmit Lyme disease, but less than 10% carry Lyme, and
the tick needs to be on your body for at least 24 hours before it is able to pass the bacteria into your bloodstream.
Ludke advises checking yourself and your children for ticks, especially after visiting grassy or off-trail areas. He says if one has started biting, to use tweezers on the whole body and pull it out firmly but slowly. Lane County Health collected about 240 ticks between April and June this year. Officials are waiting for data from the state lab on the percentage that carry tick-borne illnesses. I'm Karen Richards reporting.
The Trump administration is reversing course on its effort to shut down a network of ocean research stations in the Northwest and beyond. The National Science Foundation last week announced a halt to the removal of floating observatories off four states and the coast of Greenland. KUOW's John Ryan reports from Seattle.
The reversal comes after the Senate voted unanimously Wednesday to block the Trump administration from dismantling the ocean monitoring system. The high-tech stations have been in place for a decade off Alaska, North Carolina, the Pacific Northwest, and Greenland. They monitor ocean conditions, including storms, temperatures, and oxygen levels. Their data is available in real time to the public. Six observatories off the Northwest coast had been quietly pulled from the sea starting last September. They've been sitting in a warehouse in Corvallis, Oregon. The Science Foundation now says those observatories will go back in the water after being serviced. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Students at Southern Oregon University will see three major cuts under a new plan to slash one-fifth of the institution's budget. It's a high-stakes plan that has received pushback, with the alternative being closure. Trustee Daniel Santos supported the plan, saying he's not 100% confident they'll succeed, but he's confident they're going to try.
For those who express concerns, whether they're faculty, staff, students, or even trustees or the administration, that there really isn't a choice. I mean, we can't go back and say, no, we're not going to do this. That's not the choice. The choice is, let's go with this. Let's go with the team we saddled up with and make this happen.
Approving this plan means the university complies with state requirements to receive a $15 million bailout. SOW is set to receive half of that funding, with the rest possibly coming in the fall. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN news team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next, followed by the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The Michigan Senate advanced the four bills comprising the Michigan Voting Rights Act June 16th, the second time in 3 years the bill has been before the legislature. But it may be a difficult road in the GOP-led House. An earlier version of the bill passed the Senate in 2024, but died in the House, never having reached the floor. Since then, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority made most of the Federal Voting Rights Act unenforceable with its April Calais decision and previous opinions. June 16th, the Senate passed SB 961, which gives all voters the equal right to register and vote and commits the state to making voting more accessible. SB 962 creates a comprehensive database of election rules, voting districts, and voter records. SB 963 makes voting information available in alternative languages. And SB 964 updates rules for communicating election changes. The Senate passed the package along party lines 20-17. In the House, however, the GOP holds a 58-52 advantage, and it's unclear whether there are four Republicans who will support voting rights protections before the outcome of the midterm. Michigan's Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson said in a statement, "We must make America's promise of freedom and equality for all a reality for all Michiganders." We've linked to the Michigan Voting Rights Act bills at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.